Perhaps you just reflect on body awareness and what Bhante Rahula said right at the end of his meditation. The whole idea that there can be a kind of embodied wisdom, that our bodies aren't simply vehicles that we exploit for work, exploit for pleasure. Somehow it's just some kind of a thing that you use and pay no real attention to it, or there are things that need to be beautified all the time and rippled up or whatever, or things that we feel disgusted by because they're flabby, or you know, there are different kinds of attitudes to the body that we might have, which might be cultural, which might be personal. So our culture seems to be obsessed with obesity or anorexia or body shape or you know, all kinds of things like that. And so there can be actually quite a lot of awareness of some kind of physical form, but not really awareness of the body. We can have a kind of critical attitude to the body. But to actually have a practice of an embodied awareness, where you actually are, your consciousness is abiding in the body, not simply in thought and intellect all the time, where one is actually aware of like embodied gratitude. Because when I feel gratitude, when you feel gratitude, it's not simply, oh, thanks for the cup of tea. It's not simply a thought, but it's something that's in the body, if one is aware. And that awareness is very valuable because it can very clearly indicate attachment, non-attachment, stress, non-stress. So to become familiar with something like, just take gratitude. To actually become conversant with gratitude, to become aware of gratitude as an embodied sensibility, that I have the capacity both to notice, to understand, and to turn back to cultivate. This is wonderful, isn't it? If I take the time to understand it in that way. If, however, I don't really have body sensibility, then gratitude comes and goes, but I never really cultivate that. It's never something which is done mindfully. It's something that simply happens to me. I've been reading a very good book called A General Theory of Love, which is a really interesting analysis of the chemistry of the mind and the neuroscience of emotions. And one of the interesting chapters there is just pointing to an obvious difference between something like falling in love and loving. Our words are from the Brahma Viharas, so metta is sometimes translated as loving kindness or goodwill. And contrast that to a kind of Western idea of being in love. So my sense of that in our culture, being in love or falling in love, is something that kind of overtakes you. And one has this passionate liking relationship to something or someone, usually. And then it goes. So it sort of happens to me, and then happens, and then falls away. Whereas actually the idea of loving or metta is something that one does. It doesn't just happen to me. It's something that can be embodied. I can witness to that in an embodied way. So I can actually physically sense empathy. When I'm connected to someone, an animal or a person, there's a physical embodiment of that. And I have the capacity to both recollect that, and I have the capacity to cultivate that. Now that's different than something just happening to me. And that's different than just liking someone when the situation suits my desires or my needs or whatever. So the whole Buddhist idea around the emotional world, the world of sensibility, is both one of an understanding that we're not simply victims of life. We're not simply just receptive. Things don't just happen to us. That we have this capacity to create, to cultivate, to move towards. We have a capacity to move away from, to let go of, right? Through intention. We're quite amazing beings in that way. How much our capacity to shift our attention can change us, both physically it can affect us. So the undeveloped mind, or a life which is not considered or not contemplated, is really a life which is simply reactive. And so the undeveloped mind simply responds to negative things, like things we dislike, by just picking on those points all the time. So if you look at how aversion works in the mind, there's something in one's family or in one's relationship or one's culture that one doesn't like, that doesn't suit one for some reason. And then the mind, because it's untrained, just keeps picking up on that, what we call the sign of negativity. So I live in a house, I live in a home, I live in a monastery, I go to work, and there is some aspect of some person, or the weather, or the culture, whatever, and it doesn't suit me, it doesn't suit my desires. And the untrained mind just keeps going to that, going to that, going to that. Just keeps thinking. So if it's with people, the untrained mind finds that someone's the way they talk, maybe just the way they laugh. The way a person laughs, I might find that. I know there's this one person in one of our monasteries who has a, I would call it a cackle. It's not, I wouldn't, I think this person calls it a laugh, but my perception that it's a kind of loud cackle, right? And I've always found it unpleasant, let's put it that way, right? Now, this is a very good person. Diligent, kind, devoted to the Dhamma, but I don't like the cackle. Now, if I'm unskillful, which I have been, I can just begin to just dwell on the cackle, right? So every time I hear this so-called laughter, sense my bias, then what happens is that brings forth in me a reaction of dislike. Right? Now if I'm just heedless, then I'll just begin to see, I won't see the person anymore. I won't see their goodness. I won't see their, you know, all the goodness in life. I'll just begin to don't like the cackle, don't like the way this person laughs. In my mind, if I'm not careful, then becomes embedded in a negative response. Yeah? Now that's bad enough with that person, but then it takes on the tendency to be embedded in a negative response. The mind begins to behave that way because that's the way the mind works. If I live a life which is not, doesn't really contemplate meaning, and I just let things run the way they run according to pleasure and displeasure, then the mind will just go into channels dictated by gravity, just the gravity of lowest common denominator. So I don't like this, so my mind doesn't like it, and I'm not mindful, so my mind begins to respond in that way, and I become conditioned to suffer. And there's no freedom in that. It might not be another person's laughter, it might be my own laughter. It might be something about my own perceived behavior which I find negative, and I'll walk away from it. I will have said that, done that, performed that, whatever it is, and then I walk away from it, and because there's a sense of dislike for whatever reason, some historical reason, then my mind will keep going to that, which we call self-hatred and self-disparagement. And there'll be a million and other maybe good things which are fine about me, but the mind won't pick on those. It won't go to those. It'll go to the negative one, And someone else might say to this same person, but actually, you're all right. They say, oh, you don't really know. And the mind will go to this and go to this and go to this. That's the untrained mind. Or the mind which is badly trained or badly conditioned. Unfortunately conditioned, suffering conditioned. But in the same vein, I have the capacity to notice the laughter, shift from cackle to laughter, or shift from that negative perception to another one to say, this person wants to be free from suffering. This person lives by precepts. This person, whatever. But that's a choice I can make. And that's a choice which is called training. This is what we call training the mind. And those choices we're making all the time, aren't we? All the time we're making choices. We may not be attuned to the choices, we may not be aware of them, but we're making them. We're making them all the time. So in the Buddhist practice of the heart, to become conversant of one's own inner world in an embodied way, rather just than in an intellectual way, is most valuable, because it gives you, as Bhante was saying, a kind of parallel universe of observation. Now, the trouble with our thinking mind and our perceptual mind is quite often conditioned in ignorant ways. So let's say the person who perceives themselves to be negative in some way, their speech, their body size, something they did in the past, a myriad of things, right? And that person keeps going back to some negative put-down perception, and the mind keeps interpreting life in a thinking narrative way of, that's wrong, I shouldn't be like this, I shouldn't be like that, I shouldn't be like this. Now, that narrative, that thinking, that storyline is conditioned from unfortunate things, but it can sound very believable, can't it? You know, the kind of negative perceptions we might have of ourselves or other is the trouble with it is that it sounds right very often, and that's the nature of delusion. Now, if that's the only criteria from which I can look at myself, the thinking mind, I can get very deluded into believing all kinds of perceptions which are actually inaccurate. But if I've got a parallel way of observing life, a parallel way of considering my interplay with the beings around me, and that parallel way it's not mediated by thought, it's not biased by thought, it's not prejudiced by various kinds of conditioning. If it's just purely the way it is in the body, then I think I have a actually a much more accurate way of understanding myself and seeing the way things are. And I think this is one of the reasons that the Indian philosophy through yoga, Chinese philosophy through Tai Chi, our own ways of like body awareness are so invaluable, because they give you a whole system or a way of information which is not deluded by wrong thinking, not deluded by ego thinking. Yeah. So if I do something, I say something, I act in some way, and I walk away from that, and the habit is, say, self-hatred, or I see this person and the habit is to be highly judgmental and critical, my body will register that as stress. I'll feel that in my body, and it won't be the same feeling as gratitude, and it won't be the same feeling as compassion. It'll be different. It'll be stressful. It'll be tight. The breath will feel tighter. The heart will feel tighter. The whole system will feel tighter. And no matter what my thinking mind might say, I might really justify my judgments of the other person. I might really feel justified in my own self-aversions. That's the thinking mind that might do that. But my body will tell me, yeah, but it's still not compassion. My body will tell me it's still not gratitude. My body will tell me it's still not goodwill, no matter what the thinking mind says. So I might very well, with my rational mind, have all kinds of reasons why I hate someone, but hatred hurts. I mean, I have all kinds of neat excuses for putting myself down, but putting myself down still hurts. It's suffering, whether it's to someone else or to myself. And if that is my standard, embodied witnessing, embodied knowing of a relaxed state, a compassionate state, a gratitude state, and then its opposite, some kind of tension and conflict, then I have a very simple way of letting go. Not through thought, but through body awareness. Notice how if you try to let go through thought, you're actually usually not letting go. Sometimes you can, but quite often it's just an inner argument. I find myself being critical towards myself or the person, and then I'm saying about that person, oh, why doesn't that person learn how to, why don't they just stop laughing? Why do they have to be such a cackling idiot? And then, of course, the next thought is, well, why are you so critical? Why are you so judgmental? Why can't you stop doing that? And then the next thought is, yeah, but they cackle. Mm-hmm. And it's endless. It's just the same warfare, the same zone of suffering, because it's all in thought. It's all in thought. But one moment of body awareness, you'll notice that this is suffering. It doesn't matter if I hate myself or someone else, it's suffering. The body's not happy. It's tight. It's intention, its breath is not manifesting in an open and clear way. Then it's much easier, because you don't have to argue with yourself, you just have to relax, you have to let go, right? The same with fear, the same with greed, all the different forms of greed, hatred, delusion that we read about in the texts and experience in our hearts and minds. They'll manifest in thought, in narrative, in storyline, in ideas, in rationalizations, and they'll manifest in the body. They're not separate, really. It's one system. And if one has a sensibility to the body in this way, has an awareness in the body in this way, then I think it's actually much. You can get a much more sense of continuity in the practice, because you begin to see how the body is always reacting, as the mind is, to the kind of inputs we have, either with like or dislike. And if you see that reaction, you can continue, then you have a kind of really sustained practice of letting go. And it's not rocket science. You don't have to be that. It's a different kind of intelligence, isn't it? It's not the intelligence of having a really detailed analysis of the, you know, Paticca Samuppada and all the Abhidhamma commentaries. That's all very well and good. But this is a different kind of intelligence, isn't it? It's an embodied intelligence. And it is intelligent. And there is a kind of into, I guess that's maybe why Ajahn Sumedho, Andra Chameda uses this word intuitive awareness now. We've been doing this book on the Wednesday meetings in Ottawa. Intuitive awareness, you know, it's an interesting word in English. I mean, it's always kind of fuzzy, isn't it? What do you mean by intuition? Well, for me, the way I find myself contemplating that word is there's when there's a sense of disease in the body, and then that's saying something to me about the way I'm relating to the world. And if I get a sense of that, then I have an intuition that, oh, wait a minute, you're getting caught up with this, or you're too whatever. There's something off here, a sensibility, which becomes more and more refined. Obviously, if I get raging mad, I'm going to notice it in my body. I'd have to be complete dolt not to notice that in the body. Or if I have a panic attack, right? Or if some kind of passionate lust comes into consciousness. And those are, you know, bodily pretty obvious kinds of things. But I think what we're speaking of maybe is something far more subtle, or the possibilities are far more subtle, because not only does rage manifest through body consciousness, body sensibility, but also annoyance does, because it's the same kind of movement, it's just much more subtle. So it seems to me that if we can take the time to get to know ourselves in an embodied way, to register both the positive and the negative, to register, say, when I do feel grateful, to actually make that conscious as a part of my practice, to just say, oh, gratitude feels this way, to investigate that, and to see how relaxed that is, and to see how happy that is, right? And to have the capacity to recollect that, and what that might be, what we mean by heart memories. I have narrative memories, right? I can remember Tariq coming to my place, being 20 minutes late, me getting nervous, phoning Bhante, saying, we'll be on time, right? I can remember that as a narrative, right? So there's that kind of memory. But there's also a capacity to recollect states of mind, too. So, like the metta practice that we do, we can just think, may you be well, may you be well, may I be well, which is good. It's better than thinking, may you drop dead, right? But also, there is a capacity to recollect that at a deeper level, at a felt level, at a heart level. And all of us have felt what compassion is like here, haven't we? Well, there's something going on there, isn't there? And it relates to that part of us. We've certainly thought compassionate thoughts, fine, but we felt things too. Same with fear, right? We've had maybe anxious, fearful scenarios that we've thought a lot about, buzzed around about, but we've also felt them in our guts, in our hara, in our chest, right? So we have this capacity to feel, first of all. And then we have the capacity to take that that felt sense, bodily sense, into thought, narrative. Right? Now, if we are not living a life of mindfulness and a life where we're cultivating wholesome states of mind, then these things just happen, right? You feel grateful, you zip off into grateful thoughts. You feel anxious, you zip off into anxious thoughts. And there's just this kind of movement according to circumstances. So I call that circumstantial life. right? But actually, a life lived with mindfulness isn't just a matter of circumstance. It's not just an accident, right? If I can spend half an hour recollecting something wholesome, body awareness, as Bhante was teaching, the heart of gratitude, the heart of compassion, and really recollect them, not in some kind of abstract way, but really, what is the felt sense of that, then I undertake a kind of learning, a bodily learning, about where peace lies, where letting go lies, how it feels. And that learning becomes part of my kind of intuitive equipment, so that when I face the hurly-burly of life, when I face the complexity of life, and I've done these practices, right? I haven't just kind of read a book about it. I've actually sat down and done the work. You have to do the work. I've actually trained, as in music or in craft or whatever, actually trained in this particular way. Then when the complexity of life comes and I am challenged in some way, slapped in the face, as it were, by life circumstances, and that all those old reactions come into play, I have much better chance, first of all, not to reinforce those, to see their arising and experience a kind of purification of the heart, because I no longer am buying into them, and perhaps, if there's enough mindfulness, to shift away from them. And this is freedom. Freedom not as some kind of event, I think, that just sort of hits you in the head. Because sometimes I think people, if they think that enlightenment is like falling in love. I'll just sit here and boink, I'll fall in love, I'll get enlightened. Maybe. But the kind of, what I've noticed with most of my fellow samanas is, as I keep coming back, it's quality time. Ajahn Sona uses that quality time, that because the habits of self, the habits of self and other, in all their fearful, worrisome, lustful, greedy, hateful ways, they're so powerful, they're so insidious, that they get ingrained in consciousness in patterns that when the triggers are there, they just go off into those patterns. With this as condition, there is that. And the paticca samuppada, that kind of idea. When with this as condition, that arises. So the task is not so much that you never face fear or anger or lust or greed. That's just part of the programming that we're all working with. But the task is to no longer reinforce these set gameplays that the mind goes into. These set patterns of self that we define ourselves with. These kind of set pieces in our lives. Kind of Pavlovian, isn't it? And that's the challenge, I think. That's the challenge of letting go. Not the challenge that you never experience anything, but the challenge of not reinforcing and then shifting to something which is much more skillful. So I hear the samana, let's say, I'm sure next time I meet this person, the one with the cackle laugh or the laugh cackle, that old reaction will probably be there. Because for some reason my highly attuned ears find it unpleasant, right? So with contact, there is feeling, and the feeling is unpleasant. And what do I do with that? Do I then just go into the Pavlovian blame mode? Or do I go into the self-Pavlovian blame mode? Or do I notice that this is unpleasant? Feeling is unpleasant, and not take it any further. Not create a self, not create another, not create a version. Now that would be good mindfulness, wouldn't it? So that's the first step, or that's the last step. But usually we kind of, before we notice that, we're already in some kind of critical, frightened, lustful mode. We've taken it a bit too far. Well, then there's more homework. So let's say I go to a meeting and I hear the cackling laugher or the laughing cackler, and I'm not aware. I'm not present, right? And it starts to, it kind of creeps up on you. Creeps up on me. I don't know about you. And I'm not aware, and I think I'm aware, but actually I'm getting irritated. I'm getting irritated inside. Why? Because I haven't really been aware that this is unpleasant. I'm just going to ignore this. This isn't happening. But all the time in the back of consciousness, I'm getting annoyed. But I'm not aware of it. So then, maybe the meeting has been going on for 2 hours, and finally I tell the person, stop cackling! I've completely lost the plot because I've not been aware. Or probably, it's not that bad, I probably just start to think averse thoughts. That's because I'm not aware. Because this negative, unpleasant sound has just been coming in and I haven't been aware. And I've just been trying to, you know, be dutiful, do what I have to do. Or I might even practice loving kindness. May you be well, may you be well. But I'm not really recognizing unpleasant feels this way. This is unpleasant, feels this way. And it's only when I do that is that I'm truly awake. Now why am I not aware of that? Because I don't want it. Because I don't want the unpleasant in consciousness, I do things to avoid it. I distract, I get rid of, or I blame. But as soon as I can say, oh, unpleasant feels this way, and make it fully conscious, then oftentimes unpleasant just becomes neutral. It's not a problem. It's because of inadvertence, it's because of not really paying attention or not wanting the unpleasant into consciousness. We do this with the same, with various kinds of mind states. So there's some inner mind state of guilt or remorse or jealousy or whatever, and we don't make them fully conscious. We go into some kind of shouldn't be like that, because it's unpleasant. So we try to get rid of it through judging. And it sounds very Buddhist. You know, I shouldn't hate, I shouldn't be jealous, I should love everyone. But it's still not mindful, because it hasn't really taken on board unpleasant feels this way. And that's the desire mind. The desire mind doesn't want the unpleasant. It just wants the pleasant. So when the unpleasant comes up, delusion and ignorance have all kinds of strategies to avoid the unpleasant or to get rid of it. So hatred or distraction tend to be the strategies. But if I have body awareness, and if I've cultivated an intuitive sense of stress in me, then when the unpleasant comes, I'll have much better chance of knowing the his attachment right there, as soon as the unpleasant hits me. That's what it feels like. There won't be a residue built up because of inadvertence. But if I'm just in thought all the time, not aware of it, it can build up and I can just find myself tense and angry or whatever, because I'm not aware. The same with fear, the same with greed, the same with lust, they're kind of similar patterns. Now if I then awaken in this way continually, then I stop reinforcing the tendency of the mind to be caught by conditions. The conditions of sound, the conditions of thought, the conditions of the body, conditions of sight, conditions of smell. And as I stop being obsessed or distracted by them, my mind begins to settle into a knowing of the conditioned as the conditioned. To know thought as thought, to know the unpleasant as the unpleasant, to know the pleasant as the pleasant, to know body as body, to know mind as mind. And as I settle into that kind of awareness, then the doors open to transcendence. The doors to the deathless open, because I am no longer obsessed with the conditioned mind, with the conditions of mind. And that means the mind's really relaxed. When you come to a monastery, the idea of the monastery is not to fill the mind, right? Monasteries we try to build them in non-distracting environments. So if you've got enough clothing on, say, and you go and you look at the marsh, you look at the wetland, the idea of building a monastery in nature or going for a walk in nature is that the mind tends not to attach to conditions, unless you're kind of obsessed bird watcher or kind of obsessed botanist. But for most of us, you go out to the pond, to the lagoon, what do we call that? Geologists wanted to call it mud. I refuse to call it mud.
But,
huh?
Muck.
She called it muck. I was very offended. We go out to the wetland, and your mind just looks, doesn't it? And it has a kind of diffuse looking. And it looks in a way of kind of being very receptive and open, right? And that's what nature can do. Not necessarily the bugs might be biting you, etc. But what we quite often are involved in our daily pursuits is always looking for conditions. We're in the internet, trying to get enough answered so that we can do the next internet. Or we're processing all the little beings or big beings or old beings or young beings in our lives. We're getting things done, or we're reading information. We're taking up information, or so our minds are not very much trained in non-doing, in non-becoming. They're not very much trained in being. They're very much trained in becoming and doing, and that's good. You need to do that, because we wouldn't have this place if everyone wasn't sort of gainfully employed. So I'm not dismissing that, but there is an aspect of consciousness which is more like waiting, more like receiving, more like being, and there's also that part of consciousness where we have to do and so on. Now, hopefully what a monastic environment can do for us is that we can come to it. We can sit quietly, we can go for a walk, and we can watch this push and pull of the mind. We can watch the mind of dissatisfaction, or the mind of criticism, or the mind of judgment, and just know it as that, and begin to find a place in our hearts which is not dependent on pleasant and unpleasant, not dependent on getting what we want, when we want it, not dependent on distractions and things to do, because quite often in monastery there's nothing to do. It's just to be, isn't it? There's lots to do. I shouldn't have said that to Miriam. They've been working so hard all week. But even for them, really more important for them is that our culture doesn't know how to stop, does it? You know, our culture, the churches are locked. Can't get in them. So I think intuitively Canadians like to go out to the bush and get a sense of that. But that kind of ability to relax can be something we learn about more and more in the body in complexity. As you get a sense of that in your own body, what it means just to be, without the mind always choosing and preferring and judging and doing all of that and finding and getting rid of, and just relax in being. And if one learns that in a non-complex situation, one begins to intuit that, or know that, or feel that in ordinary life. And then it's a very valuable tool, because in ordinary life, our triggers are getting pressed, and our reactions are being reinforced, and karma is being generated. The law of karma, unfortunately, doesn't take a vacation. So I might... inadvertence, still, you still have to pay the price. So if I'm in a work situation and my mind is just becoming overly critical, that's very unhealthy, both physically and karmically, because that kind of critical, judgmental, hateful mind is something I'm going to have to work on. It's going to be something, you know, I'm going to have to pay for that. So there's a kind of imperative in this practice to really get on with it, to really be careful, to see the importance of every moment in what we do. And body awareness can be a rather wonderful way of understanding yourself and wearing out these patterns and not buying into them. Now people will say, well, I'm so busy, I can't do that. But the more you do it, the more that intuition is a parallel universe, as Bhante Singh, or a parallel way of knowing, even when you're talking, even when you're in committee meetings, you begin to just sense it more and more, don't you? Because you're more aware. But it does take time out, I suppose. It does take situations where you can do that. So let's finish there with the chant. If we do the metta chant in English, some of us know it, some of us don't. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.